This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Miriam Kaba is an organizer, speaker, and author. She is also the founder of Project NEA, which is dedicated to ending youth incarceration. Miriam Kaba will deliver the annual MLK convocation Monday morning at 10:50 in Stetson Chapel on the Kalamazoo College campus. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
How big a problem is youth incarceration if we look across the country at, you know, minors who are actually behind bars?
Every year we have about 60,000 young people incarcerated across the country on any given day. And that number has steadily come down over the last 25 years. The 1990s were pretty much a peak time for youth incarceration. That wouldn't surprise anybody who remembers the rhetoric around super predators and the coming demonization of all these black and brown kids who were crack-addicted babies who were going to, you know, maraud our streets and cause all sorts of harm. So that was that period of that kind of moral panic. So a lot of people were much more likely to criminalize young people. So that is an issue. I think the bigger issue for young people is criminalization as opposed to incarceration, and that means arrest. You know, there are millions of arrests of young people every year, and whatever contact a young person has with the law is often criminogenic. So it's basically leads them down paths of further criminalization. So what we want to do is address youth criminalization more broadly, and as part of that, certainly address youth incarceration. I think it's important to put into context that at the same time that, you know, youth incarceration was increasing, we also had a general increase in incarceration writ large for adults as well. The numbers of young people behind bars have come down a lot more steeply over the years than the numbers of adults who are incarcerated currently in our system. We have well over 2.2 million people in our prisons and jails in terms of adult people who are criminalized. So that's a little bit of background about that.
Well, I want to go back to what you said about the numbers coming down. That period would coincide roughly with the time when the crime rate was going down as well. So I guess what I'm wondering is that simply what happened there, that there was, you know, not as much crime, or were there some real reforms out there that led to fewer young people being put behind bars?
Yeah, you know, so interestingly enough, the rate at which juveniles who had committed serious violent crimes decreased was at its peak was kind of in 1993, where we had a rate of confinement of juveniles who committed serious crimes of like 52 per 1,000 youth. That went down as of 2015 to 7.6 per 1,000 youth. So that tells you something about kind of, you know, in terms of the commitment rates of young people, how big of a decrease that's been over that period of time. So I think the important thing to understand is there were huge amounts of reforms that definitely happened that pushed this to occur. Over the years, there's been, especially in places like Texas and New York State, there's been a huge push to close down youth prisons. Also, Massachusetts was a leader in this as well. Illinois has followed suit. That the people understood that those jails were actually schools for more criminality. That what ended up happening is young people were basically incarcerated, and what they ended up doing was learning how to become, quote, better at crime. And so they decided that it was important to actually have community-based alternatives, and that those did more to both end recidivism and also to actually curb any sort of, quote, unquote, behavior that we didn't want young people to engage in. So those reforms are real, you know, not just the closures, not just diversion programs, so moving young people who were picked up for a crime and making sure that they didn't end up behind bars in the first place. There have been real reforms over the years. And some states like Missouri, which, you know, Sacramento has something people have been calling the Missouri Miracle, where they moved and devolved everything to community-based efforts instead of large prisons and places where young people were under confinement. That's been something that has had a huge impact in both decreasing who is behind bars and the numbers, but also basically having a huge impact on decreasing violence.
So when it comes to prison, you describe yourself as an abolitionist. Explain what that means to our audience.
Sure. I'm an abolitionist, and really that just means that I work towards making sure that the conditions that lead people to feeling like they need prisons and police and surveillance are transformed so that people feel a sense that those systems are unnecessary. So making those systems obsolete. So the real focus is that, you know, my focus has been not just on dismantling the current systems of policing and prisons and surveillance, but also on building up quote-unquote alternatives to those particular institutions. So making sure that we think about how do we address harms without relying on the punishing state? How do we address harms in our communities in restorative and in transformative ways? So that's a little bit about what that means in terms of in practice and as it relates to my organizing. So I've been involved in campaigns to close youth prisons, successful campaigns in Illinois. For example, I lived in Chicago for over 20 years before I moved back home to New York last year, or in 2016. So that is basically how I would define myself.
Now, I know that you say that you get tired of the question that comes about, of course, and I understand perhaps why, but I also know that my audience will wonder what I'm thinking if I don't ask it. What sort of world could we have where we don't have prisons or police? What are the alternatives to that if you truly are going to abolish them?
I think that's a fair question. I think that's a collective, it's going to be a collectively decided solution and an alternative. I'll say this, the prison and police and all these institutions that people take as the norm are relatively new in human history. We did not always have police or policing. We did not always have prisons and jails. So people found ways, you know, these institutions, particularly the prison itself, was a reform advanced in the late 18th century as a alternative to quote-unquote capital punishment and corporal punishment. So, you know, people have always imagined ways to hold people accountable for harm. And I think the focus for me is the Abolitionist Project's main interest, as I mentioned, is creating the different conditions that would reshape our relations to each other. And that means that you know, if you are doing work around giving people a living wage, or if you're doing work around making sure that everybody has housing, shelter, if you are doing work around ensuring that our kids have a good education, if you are doing environmental justice work, all that is abolitionist work. Because what that means is that we would create a society where people's needs would be met, where people would necessarily have different relations to each other because their needs were met. We can't even begin to imagine how that would shift what we think we need in terms of, quote, safety and wellness. So that's how I would respond to that. And I would say the question is not what do we do with all the bad people? The question is what do we do to address the needs and the root of oppression and how that shapes what people end up doing to each other. Once that shifts and changes, I can't even imagine what that society looks like yet. And that would then definitely devolve to figuring out how we treat each other in better ways overall. So, yeah. And I always tell people, too, that if you understand who's actually behind bars, then you would have a less fearful response to the idea of abolition, right? The idea that all the people that are locked up are murderers and rapists. Well, you know, less than 5% of the people currently locked up are in prisons and jails because of murder and or sexual violence. So 95% of the people are not
in there for those kinds of things. So if that's your big concern, then really then you should have a prison population and a jail population of less than 5%, because everybody else then can afford to be let free and loose. If those are supposedly the things that really worry everybody as to why we can't have even an imagined sense of having no prisons and police or jail or surveillance. So that's how I would answer that.
But there is quite a gap between the idea then of reform, where you say, well, we do have too many people behind bars, and so we should work to release those who shouldn't be there and change our laws so that we don't put people behind bars unless we deem it truly necessary. And going to the point of saying, you know, we don't need prisons anymore. There's quite a gap, isn't it?
Nope, not at all. Abolitionists engage in reforms all the time. How do we get from where we are to where we need to be without engaging in reforms? What we don't do is we engage in what we call non-reformist reforms. So that means reforms that don't actually work to cement the current system, which is atrocious. Reforms that don't actually reinforce the very thing you're trying to dismantle. So certainly we'll support any sort of opportunities to close prisons and opportunities to make sure that people who are currently behind bars are not further harmed. So, you know, you want to end solitary confinement, for example, which is a torture. There's all sorts of reforms that people who are abolitionists support, and not just support, but actually work towards. I do a lot of work around, you know, trying to ameliorate conditions for those who are currently behind bars, while also making sure to reduce the reach of the current system. So I don't think people should be, you know, I think if you want to do work towards, quote unquote, reforming the system, that's not in opposition to having an abolitionist ideology.
Is there another country which you think is one that the United States could look at and say that's the model that would get us on the path towards what you're talking about?
No. The main reason is that I can't imagine the United States becoming Scandinavia. That is not our country's history, you know? We're going to have to make our own systems based on the histories and the cultural practices of this particular nation. I think, you know, people look at things and they say, well, the Swedes hardly have anybody locked up. Well, if you go to Sweden, that's true. Very, very homogeneous country. But when you look at who is actually locked up, it's all the other folks, right? So meaning that, you know, that whole concept of the other and those ideas still manifest within those, you know, Scandinavian countries. Those are the ones that are usually brought up as the models for how we address issues of correction and punishment. But, you know, we don't have a Scandinavian state. We don't have a welfare state like the countries like Finland and in Sweden. We don't meet all the healthcare needs of our people. We don't give free education across the board up until through college. That's not a system that we currently have in the U.S. And I can't, so we're going to have to create our own systems that actually meet with what the cultural imperatives are of the country. And that means creating something new. Who knows what that new thing is going to be. In the meantime, we should do everything we can to actually shrink the reach of the prison industrial complex. And you're going to, you know, use all different methods of reform that are non-reformist to actually get from where we are to where we need to go. I don't see a particular country that we can point to and say, we're like them and we could do that.
But part of what you're saying there is that this is tied to many other issues that would
Absolutely.
Have to be addressed if you're going to really bring the prison population down and ultimately get to the point where, as you say, we wouldn't need prisons.
Absolutely. That's the whole point, which is that if in order to actually get to an abolitionist horizon, everything has to change. Right? And that's just the bottom line. Because everything, all those things that I mentioned before, all the conditions that have to be in place to allow people to even imagine a different form of safety and wellness, that is like profound systemic and institutional and cultural shifts. and changes that need to be occurring, which is why I always say if you're an abolitionist, then you're pro-changing everything. And so that means that you're, like, basically agnostic about, you know, how we go about trying to get that. Like, you're supportive of people who are doing really transformative things in education. You're supportive of people who are trying to get health care for all. You're supportive of those kinds of organizing feats, because that's all going to lead to what we hope is an abolitionist horizon.
You are critical of both political parties when it comes to the issue of the prison industrial complex. But,
yes.
You know, one looking at the last election might also conclude that the candidate who spoke more loudly and vociferously about law and order was elected president, President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Given that current climate, what sort of hope do you have for making progress?
That's a really great question. I appreciate you asking it. The great thing to think about on a regular basis as it relates to criminal punishment issues is that most of the work is done and happens at the municipal and at the state level. The criminal, you know, punishment policies are mostly set at the state level and at the levels of counties. And in some case, very minimal cases, you know, cities in terms of ordinances. So we have lots and lots of power at the local level to make a whole bunch of different kinds of shifts that would actually bring down significantly the rates of people who are both incarcerated and criminalized. So I want people to think about, for example, the fact that your county is really who runs the jail, right? You know, often it's your sheriff that's the head of the jail. So, you know, that it's the state prison population is by, you know, many folds bigger than the federal prison population, right? So if you look at who's the federal prison population is like, at, you know, 200 or a little over 200,000 people. But if you look at our state incarceration, there's, you know, in terms of state prisons, there's like over 1.5 million people who are locked up at that level. And then if you look at our jails, we're about 700,000 people there. So that is where we can make a huge difference. It's in our local places that we live. And there we have a lot more access, frankly, to the elected officials and politicians. You're not going to get to the president, you know, that you're just not, as an individual citizen, you're not going to be able to, you'll be able to sign a petition or maybe go and put a sign up in front of the White House or whatever. But you have access to your governors. You have access to your state reps and your state senators. You have access to your mayors. You have access to your county officials in a way that you never will be able to reach the federal government. So I have a lot of hope at the local level that we'll be able to do a whole bunch of things. And if you look state by state, you're seeing, you know, the best examples of reforms that have stuck and worked have come from the states and have come from counties. Whether you think about bail reform and the ways in which that is a huge decarcerative tool, because if we end money bail right now, which basically is why about 450,000 people are currently locked up in our jails, is because they can't afford to actually pay their way out because they are too poor to do so. If you ended in, you know, money bail, then that's a huge number of people who could be out into the back into their communities, you know, going back to their jobs and holding down their families and not, you know, while they're fighting their cases. We know that overwhelmingly in the system, 98% of all cases that are adjudicated in our system are plea deals. People are convicted because they just took a plea. And part of how they coerce pleas is by locking you up in jail for sometimes many, many years before you've actually gone to trial at all or had an opportunity to go to trial. So if even 5% more of the people who are currently locked up insisted on going to trial, it would crash the whole system. So bail becomes this coercive way to force people into taking pleas because our system can't actually afford to run otherwise. So those kinds of things are, you know, state laws make a difference there. Supreme Court decisions in your state make a difference there. Municipalities putting out ordinances that prohibit their judges from actually imposing bail. There are so many things that people could do. So I'm really optimistic, or hopeful, I should say, as opposed to optimistic, hopeful about what's going to be possible as a result, despite what's happening at the federal level.
Miriam Kaba is the founder of Project NEO, which aims to end youth incarceration. She will deliver the annual MLK convocation Monday morning at 10:50 in Kalamazoo College's Stetson Chapel. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
You can find links to Miriam Kaba's blog and other writing at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.